Welcome, particularly to those who weren't with us last night. And we're doing this series on courageous faith, courageous living. And we started last evening looking at a few verses in Isaiah and just looking at what trust was about. Courageous trust. And the few verses in Isaiah were just about how we so easily hold up our own flaming torches. That's what it talks about. The things that we can so easily hold on to instead of holding on to God. The things that can become too important in our lives. The things that we can so easily find ourselves turning to instead of turning to Him and trusting in Him alone. So we looked at courageous trust, and then this morning we're going to be looking at courageous obedience. And we're going to be looking at a character in the Old Testament. We're going to be looking at Gideon. And I just love the Bible. I love the way it throws open these characters, these extraordinary characters for us. I'm just fascinated by people, so I always love just taking a closer look at these characters in the Bible. And I thought I might just start with a favourite little story of mine about a mother of character. Brian invited his mother over for dinner. During the course of the meal, Brian's mother couldn't help but notice how beautiful Brian's flatmate, Jennifer, was. Brian's mum had long been suspicious of a relationship between Brian and Jennifer, and this only made her just that little bit more curious. So over the course of the evening, while watching the two interact, she started to wonder. There maybe was something more between Brian and Jennifer that met the eye. Of course, reading his mum's thoughts, Brian volunteered, "Look, I know what you're thinking, mum, but I assure you, Jennifer and I are just good friends." Anyway, about a week later, Jennifer came to Brian and said, "You know, ever since your mother came to dinner, I've been unable to find that beautiful silver gravy ladle. You don't suppose she took it, do you?" Brian said, "Well, I doubt it, but I'll send her an email just to be sure." So he sat down and wrote, "Dear Mum, I'm not saying that you did take the gravy ladle from our flat. I'm not saying that you did not take the gravy ladle, but the fact remains that one has been missing ever since you were here for dinner. Love, Brian." Several days later, Brian received an email back from his mother that read, "Dear Brian, I'm not saying that you do sleep with Jennifer. I'm not saying that you do not sleep with Jennifer. But the fact remains that if Jennifer is sleeping in her own bed, she would have found the gravy ladle by now. Love, Mum." That's what I call a mother of character. Anyway, this morning we're looking at courageous obedience and the character of Gideon, a man who, from his first introduction to us in Judges chapter 6, doesn't strike you as either courageous or obedient. He's got a long way to go. So let me remind you of how his story began. And if you've got Bibles with you, maybe you'd like to turn to Judges 6. And we'll start at verse 11. So Judges 6, and start at verse 11. If you always, like me, get confused with all these little books in the Old Testament, it comes before the big ones of Samuel and Chronicles. So, verse 11. "The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a winepress to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, 'The Lord is with you, mighty warrior.' 'But sir,' Gideon replied, 'if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian.' And the Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?' 'But Lord,' Gideon asked, 'how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh and I am the least in my family.' The Lord answered, 'I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together.' Gideon replied, 'If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you.' And the Lord said, 'I will wait until you return.'" The beginning of this chapter tells us that the Israelites have yet again lost faith in God and are now victims to the superpowers, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the eastern powers. And all those powers are sort of surrounding them at this time. It's a dark time in Israel's history. And into this mess, we find Gideon, who has inherited all the fear, all the insecurities, all the distrust of his nation. He's a man who questions both his background and his capabilities. And you need to understand, he's not being modest here. He was being totally honest. He had good self-awareness, this man. This is who he is. He has deep insecurities. Verse 13, how could God have abandoned us? In other words, abandoned me as well as my people. He has low self-esteem. Verse 15, how can I save Israel? I'm from the weakest clan. I'm the least in my family. He's inherited a legacy of fear. Verse 18, please don't leave me, he begs God. He has doubts, not just about himself, but about God. Verse 13, if God is with us, why has all this happened to us? And he needs constant reassurance. If we read on to the end, to verse 39, he said, let me make one more request, then I will know. And we have, if you remember, that ridiculous fiasco with the fleece and the dew and the dew and the fleece. Gideon is a most unlikely hero. But this was the man God chose to save Israel at this time. And it's quite honestly, it's not a very promising start. But as Oswald Chambers says, all through history, God has chosen and used nobodies. Gideon was a nobody who became a somebody because he grew in both trust and obedience. But here at the beginning of his story, we find someone who's very cautious, someone who asks a lot of questions, demanding proof at every turn. Someone who doesn't yet trust himself, let alone God. And he quite honestly doesn't seem to have an ounce of courage in his body. You know, throughout his life, up until then, he has simply learnt bitterness and mistrust. That's what the Israelites have learnt over this past generation. This is Gideon's heritage. And God has to turn that faithless mindset around for Gideon to be effective in his kingdom. And one of the first things Gideon needs is assurance. Why me of all people, Lord? But God knows his weakness, and he meets him there. And Gideon, of course, isn't the only character in the Bible to question their suitability for the task God sets them. Just listen to this list of excuses. Abraham was too old, Jacob was insecure, Leah was pathetic, Joseph was abused, Moses stuttered, Rahab was immoral, Elijah was suicidal, Jeremiah was depressed, Jonah was a coward, Naomi was homesick, John the Baptist was eccentric, Peter was hot-tempered, Martha was grumpy, Zacchaeus was unpopular, Timothy was timid, and Thomas was full of doubts. But we all have our excuses, don't we? I wonder what yours might be. I don't believe it's any mistake that the Bible allows us to see, often in great detail, poor things, what an unpromising bunch all these men and women are, or were. It wasn't easy for them to step out in faith, to obey God's call. It was no different for them than it is for us. They felt inadequate. They doubted their ability. They even doubted God. But the point is, they didn't stop there. At some point in their lives, they chose to do a U-turn from their inadequacies. They chose to do a U-turn, and instead of following their natural instincts, they chose to follow God's call, to obey him, to step out in faith. And exercising faith is all about taking risks, isn't it? Stepping out in faith will always involve risk of some sort. Because every time we step out into the unknown for God, we get to that point when it's not our stuff any longer. It's not about us. It's about him. It's kingdom stuff. But you know, that's the most exhilarating place to be. Let me ask you a question. When do you think you have most vividly experienced God working in and through you? When have you most vividly experienced God working in and through you? What was the situation? What did it feel like? What was it like for you? Actually, why don't you just turn to the person next to you and just tell them. Just tell them something about yourself, something about an experience of God that you've had. An experience when he, you know that it was him, not you. It was him who gave you a prompting or a word or a desire or a motivation or that confidence to step out in faith. Just turn to each other just for a moment. I wonder how far back we have to go to remember. And I would imagine for most of us, our most real experiences of God have been when we've stepped beyond where we thought we could go. And if that's the case, the question is, why don't we do it more often? Why don't we do it more often? I remember the first time I went into Wandsworth Prison. I went in to help with something called the Sycamore Tree Course. I don't know if you know it, it's a restorative justice program. It tries to help prisoners to see the consequences of their crime. And at a certain point in the course, they ask a victim of crime to come in and tell the men their story, what it felt like for them, the ripple effect of the crime that was committed. And I went in actually on behalf of our son, Max, who, when he was about 14, he came home from school. He was at home on his own. It was about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Went to answer the door, and two masked men pushed their way in and tied him up and basically just pushed and bullied him around the house, grabbing what they could. And it was a very traumatic experience for him, but he was okay. And I was asked to go in and just to tell this story. And I must admit, even going into a prison, for any of you who have done that, it's a very daunting experience, you know, these clanking doors. And then being faced with a room full, probably about half the size of this, but there were about 20 or 30 men there, all looking fairly sort of bolshy, you know, because they often have to, you know, go on these courses because it gets, you know, sort of ticks on against their name and gives them privileges. So they're not necessarily there because they want to be there. And I certainly felt to myself going in, my goodness, this is a very little story. This is not a big thing. And they're going to probably say, well, there are worse things that can happen to people, quite frankly. So I went and I very tentatively told this story. And as I was telling it, I just remembered one little phrase that Max had said. It just came to my mind at that time. And, you know, as you're talking, even as I'm talking now, I'm thinking to myself, shall I add that, shall I not? And I thought, yeah, okay. And I just said to them, one little thing he kept saying to me was, I'm so sorry, it's all my fault. And I just said this out to them. I said, you know, this is what he kept saying. And I would say to Max, why do you think it's your fault? I let them in, he said. I let them in, and they stole this, and they stole that. It was my fault. And afterwards, a man came up to me, and he was quite rattled. And he said, you must go home. He said, I've written this to your boy. He said, you must go home and tell him it's not his fault. It's not his fault. He's got to know that. And and actually, the relationship with this man continued. And he made a little origami bird that he sent to Max. And he would whenever people came out from the prison, he would send out a bar of chocolate or something like that for him. And it was only just last year that I had a surprising encounter with him. I went to a friend's house. She runs the Sycamore Tree Course Project. And I went to her house, and this man was there. He's the local rat catcher now. And and he was there. And it was like meeting sort of an old friend. And he said to me, you know, that was a turning point for me, your talk, in just understanding, you know, what it meant, what I was part of. And he had got early release, and there he was trying to hold down a job. And for me, I can tell you, it was one of the most daunting things going in to this bunch of men. But to know the ripple effect of what God can do when we step out in faith was just extraordinary. Because if we always play it safe, if we only do what we know we can do, we may avoid the possibility of failure, but we also avoid the possibility of growth. And at this point in his story, Gideon has only learnt to play safe. And he hasn't yet realized that that's not the way God does things. At this point, he's not willing to step out in obedience. He's uncertain and he wants proof. He's scared and he wants reassurance. He's lacking in faith and he needs convincing. This was the raw material that God was working with. But God knew, of course, what he was taking on. And I wonder what sort of raw material God is working with here in this room among us. God knows what he's taken on. God knew who Gideon was, but he also knew who he would become. He was one of the faithless Israelites, but God speaks this amazing prophetic word through the angel. He says to him, I wonder if you noticed, the Lord is with you, you mighty warrior. Now, the last thing Gideon must have looked like at that moment, as he cowered behind the wine press, trying to thresh his wheat, was a mighty warrior. He was threshing his wheat inside to try and hide from the Midianites. Doing this ridiculous thing. But God knew exactly who he was, but he also knew who he would become. And Gideon, to give him his due, knew what he was too. There's an endearing honesty in this conversation with God. You know, he says, I feel abandoned like all the other Israelites. I feel weak like the rest of my poor tribe. I feel unsure because I don't know you well enough, God. I don't know yet if I can trust you. And he says all this quite openly to God. But he also says, this is what I believe so far, verse 17. If you stay with me, Lord, I'm prepared to go a bit further. And I'm sure God loves to see that sort of vulnerability in all of us. That willingness to say, I've gone this far in my walk with you, Lord. But if you are with me, I'm willing to go that little bit further. And I just love it when I see or hear people in our congregation volunteering for things. You know, volunteering to help on Alpha or with Food Bank. Or joining the welcoming team or going into the prison on Alpha or Sycamore Tree. Because I know that there's usually a story behind each one. You know, they're usually doing something they have never done before. They're doing it because God has prompted them and they're taking a bit of a risk. They're stepping into a new place. They're obeying God's call. God's not necessarily looking for the ones who can do it all. He's looking for those who'll risk going just that little bit further than they've been before. I was speaking on using our gifts one Sunday, and just as a simple sort of visual aid, I'd wrapped up two big boxes, a sort of beautiful present, you know, with a big bow on the top. And I'd asked people, as I was speaking, to simply hand these boxes along the rows to each other, just as a sign of how we're ready to give what we have to each other. You know, our gifts are for the body. And when the gifts got to the last person, the very last person at the back, I just asked if that person, whoever it was, would bring the gift forward and just leave it on the steps at the front, just as a sign that all that we have comes back to God. And after the service, a lovely young Ghanaian woman came up to me and told me that the evening before, she'd wrapped up and put in a bag three things: a bottle of spirits, her last packet of cigarettes, and some pills. And she felt prompted, God wanted her to bring them to church and just leave them there as a sign that she wanted to move on. And at the last moment, she'd left them behind. She'd come to church a bit late without them and then found that she was the last person at the back with the gift in her lap to bring it forward to the front. And she knew, she said to me after, she knew God was saying to her, it's okay, it's okay. You didn't manage to bring your gift to me, but I had one ready for you here. You know, we can do this together. God is so gracious, isn't he? He knows us. He knows our heart. He knows when we've risked it. He knows when we've blown it. And he doesn't desert us. He stays with us. He'd given her the opportunity to step out in obedience, to step out of old habits, old ways. And she'd heard his prompting. And she'd responded to his call that night before. She knew what she should do. She'd tried. And she'd nearly made it, but not quite. And God came to meet her, just like the prodigal son. He came to meet her. And throughout this passage, God is teaching Gideon to trust him just that little bit more. And God's first words to him are that extraordinary prediction, you will be a mighty warrior. And a very simple promise, the Lord is with you. The Lord is with you. And repeated more personally in verse 16, I will be with you. And you can go through a lot with a promise like that, can't you? It doesn't answer your question about details, nothing about when or how or where or why. Only the who. I will be with you. That little promise means everything. The Lord is with you. The Lord will be with you. And it's actually all we need to know. You know, whatever we're facing, whatever we might be asked to face in the future, if we know that truth, if we know that he's for us, he's with us, he'll never let us go, then we'll be prepared to face most things. And that's what God is teaching Gideon here, to be a man of faith rather than a man of fear. And that's the main thing that God is dealing with here in Gideon, fear. Fear of failure, fear of trusting God again, fear of the enemy, fear of being let down. Now I wonder what fears prevent you and me from stepping out into new areas of faith. What are we afraid of? What are we afraid of? What people will think? What might be demanded of us? What it might show up about us? What it might lead on to? How we might look? How we might cope? What is it we're afraid of? You see, for the past 7 years, the Israelites have lived in an atmosphere of fear. Fear has dominated their lives and undermined their faith. You just have to look back to the beginning of the chapter to just see what a pitiful state they were in. They lived in fear, running to hide in caves, verse 2. The Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves and strongholds. They lived without stability because they knew they could be invaded at any time, verse 3. Whenever they planted their crops, the Midianites, the Amalekites and other eastern peoples invaded the country and they camped on the land and ruined the crops. They lived in poverty, their crops ruined, their animals taken, verse 4. They didn't spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep, nor cattle, nor donkeys. Don't you love the detail? And they lived under oppression. Their enemies are described as swarms of locusts because they're so many and they're so destructive. Verse 5. And into this desperate picture, Gideon has his unlikely calling. Out of obscurity, out of faithlessness, out of fear. Gideon emerges this unlikely hero. And as we move into the action in chapter 7, something extraordinary happens to him. Now, I wonder if you notice what it is as I read just the first 8 verses in chapter 7. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. In order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her, announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. If I say, this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go." So Gideon took the men down to the water. And there the Lord told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink." 300 men lapped with their hands in their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place." So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley. Now I wonder, did you notice anything different? No more questions. No more questions. Right through the last chapter, Gideon asked endless questions. He demanded ridiculous signs. He bleats and whines at every opportunity. Nothing is certain, nothing is clear. It's all too hard, it's all too difficult for him. It's not that he's being consciously disobedient, But he has an excuse for everything God asks him to do. A reason why not. You know, I'm not the right person. It's not the right time. I've not got the right gifts. I'm not in the right place. Do any of those things sound familiar? They do to me. But now that's suddenly all stopped. Gideon is now ready to obey without question. And chapter 7 is like a series of tests for Gideon. It seems as though God is pushing him right to the edge, testing his obedience, testing his faith, testing his courage. I heard someone say just the other day, if you're not living life on the edge as a Christian, you're taking up too much space. And Gideon is certainly living life on the edge, because the odds are against him from the start. And what does God do? He simply increases them. Gideon had amassed a fairly decent sized army. Now, you probably haven't had time to do the maths, but I have. It's 32,000 men by my calculations. 32,000 men came to join him. Not insignificant, particularly from a nation that had been dispersed and disparate. But God's first test for Gideon is that he should send most of them home. Anyone who's in the least bit afraid, verse 2, who trembles with fear, send them home. Send them home. Now, you may think to yourself, you know, good decision, fair enough. You know, you want people who are up to the job. But what you don't see, because it's not properly revealed until later in the chapter, is that the Midianite army numbered at least 150,000. Now, that's five times bigger than the Israelites, even before they started being choosy. Who wouldn't tremble with fear at that? So from just over 30,000 men, Gideon's left with 10,000. But then God pushes Gideon one step further. He sets him another test, this separation of the lappers from the kneelers. Weird. Now, what's that all about? Well, it's nothing to do with what I learnt at Sunday school, which is that the lappers are the clever ones, because they've got their eyes out. They can scoop the water up and they can keep their eyes out for the enemy, whereas the kneelers have got their heads in the trough. They can't see a thing. They're way open for attack. Nothing to do with that. It's all to do with verse 2. That's the key verse. Just look back at it. Verse 2. It's all in order that Israel may not boast that her own strength has saved her. That's what it's all about. It's simply a further way of God reducing the size of Gideon's army so that what? So that they learn dependence on him. So that it's totally clear whose victory this really is. So Gideon is now down to just 300 men from just over 30,000. They're not even Israel's best. You know, the tests are far too arbitrary. They're just a small band of men standing against the massive force of the Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the other eastern people, verse 12, who we're told were thick as locusts in the valley below, with camels that could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. Great description, isn't it? But terrifying, terrifying. And as Gideon looks down on them, he starts to lose confidence. But you know, we'll always meet with opposition when we strive to be obedient. What will happen? We've got to expect it. When we try to do what's right, everything and anything will seem to come against us. Don't you find that? When we set priorities for ourselves, everything will seem to come against those. Can I tell you just at this point, just one of our favourite family stories, one of the stories, I don't know if you have them, a story that goes down in family folklore, one that's repeated often. It was soon after we moved to our first parish, and Paul and I were just consumed with the job, with the work in hand. We were a church plant, the church was falling down around our ears, we had 50 people who were all looking up to us to make a go of this, and we were on the edge. But we realised that we were going to have to work really hard to prioritise time with each other and time with our young family. We knew this was something we couldn't afford to take for granted. You know, it had to be a number one priority if we were going to hold things together. So one of the things we decided was to carve out some quality family time every day from 5 till 7. And at 6 o'clock, we'd have supper together, make a real effort. We're a great family for sort of candles and music and all that sort of stuff. So create atmosphere, make it a place where, you know, it's just us. But as soon as we sat down for supper, the phone would start ringing. And we would be stupid enough to answer it. yeah, you say, why would you do that? But anyway, the phone this particular supper time must have rung a dozen times or so during our quality family supper time. And it rung yet again, and this time Max, who was about four or five years old at the time, jumped up from the table and said, I'll answer it. And I can remember Paul and I looking at each other admiringly and saying, oh, he's such a good boy, so sweet, so helpful. Max, meanwhile, picked up the phone and in a theatrical whisper simply said, go away. And good man. To this day, actually, we don't know who was on the end of the phone. They never admitted it. But when we decide to do what's right, something will always come against us. Something will always try to prevent us. We have to be prepared to push through. We have to be prepared to hold on. We have to be prepared to make those choices and stay with them. And for Gideon, as soon as he starts looking at the size and strength of the enemy and comparing it with his own meagre army, he grows fearful. The opposition looks too great. It looks too big. But God knows. God knows before Gideon even voices those fears. God knows what he's feeling. And he says, verse 10, if you're afraid, Gideon, if you're afraid, come on, let's go down into the middle of the enemy camp. And I'll prove to you that there's no need to be afraid. There's no need to compare. Because comparison cripples us, doesn't it? It always puts us down. It threatens us. It leaves us feeling either envious or inadequate. One or the other, or sometimes both together. We used to do a school run with a couple called John and Ellie Mumford. I don't know if any of you know them, but they now head up the Vineyard movement. But at that time, they had just started their first Vineyard church, just a few miles away from us. They started it almost exactly the same time as we started our church plant in Battersea. And we did this school run together with their boys and our kids, and they would often come, one or other of them, and have breakfast with us when they dropped them off. And John and Paul, when they got together, they would often sit up the end of the table with a cup of coffee talking about church things and asking each other very politely about how things were going, trying to avoid any hint of comparison or competition, but one morning John's little boy James, he must have been about 7, couldn't stand it any longer, and he blurted out with his mouth full of cornflakes, yes, but who's winning? And it was a wonderful moment. It's a risky thing, though, being open and honest about our fears, about our failings, about our anxieties. But, it can be a very powerful thing. And in the Christian community, in the Christian family, we can risk being real with each other. And we can risk being different from each other. Gideon is now showing all the signs of becoming an extraordinary individual leader. I mean, I'm sure his troops couldn't believe the half of what he was asking them to do. The fact is, Gideon has learnt to listen. And he now hears God more clearly than ever before. That's what happens when you step out in obedience. You grow in the ability to both hear and to act. One feeds into the other. And it's very significant that little phrase, the Lord said, comes 12 times in just those two chapters. 12 times the Lord said to Gideon. We can only obey if we hear instructions, and we can only hear if we are consciously listening. And we need to make it a habit of listening out for God. Make it a daily habit. I found that I hear him best in the everyday when I expect to hear him. And one of the ways I've increased my expectations is by getting into the habit, as I just go out my front door, of just saying a simple little phrase to myself. Give me something of you, Lord, to pass on to somebody today. That's what I say as I close my front door and walk out. Give me something of you, Lord, to pass on to someone today. Now, that doesn't sound like much, and it's not. I'm not very proud of it. It's the least I can do. But, even a small prayer like that has an impact on how I spend the rest of my day. I've got something of God's agenda on my mind. I'm on the lookout for that someone. Who is it you want me to talk to? Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to do? Not long ago, it was a lady in the checkout queue at Tesco's. you know, it was a rather long queue, as usual. And I remember I turned to her and I just thought, I started up a conversation. And she wasn't very responsive. And I was just about to give up and just, you know, focus on the queue, when I just felt God prompt me to say to her, "You're having a bit of a hard time at the moment, aren't you?" "Okay, for you, Lord, I'll do it." So I did. I said, "You know, are you having a bit of a hard time at the moment? You look as if things are weighing down on you." And suddenly she was telling me about the debts she couldn't pay, the children who were playing truant. And I thought to myself, this is that someone, isn't it, Lord? This is that someone. And I was able to say to her, "You know, I'm part of a congregation, a local congregation. We have an experienced man on our staff who can help you with your debts for free. He can talk to you. Do you want to come and see him? Can I put you in touch with him?" And a few days later, she came and talked with Dan, our cat worker. And then she came on our church weekend with her and her family. Just because, all because of just a chance conversation in a checkout queue in Asda. Tesco's, what did I say? I go to one or the other. Mind you, it doesn't always work out as we hope, does it? I was walking past the Grand, it's called. It's not very grand. It's a very seedy sort of concert venue outside Clapham Junction. And there was some event going on that afternoon that had attracted an extraordinary bunch of, quite frightening actually, group of individuals, you know, all clad in sort of leather and lots of studs everywhere. And they were all standing outside on the pavement in sort of groups drinking. And I was scurrying past with my shopping. And again, God just prompted me, said, "You know, why didn't you just go up and say hello to one of them? Ask them what's going on there that afternoon." That took me a bit of time. I must have walked up and down that road about three times just to simply summon up the courage. But I did. I went up to a group of what I thought were the least frightening looking girls there. But I can't believe I said it as an opener. I said, "Hello, I'm the local vicar's wife." And I was... And I was just wondering what's going on here this afternoon. And I got an unrepeatable response, and their backs turned to me, and I sort of skulked away, shamefaced. And I can remember saying to God, "Well, that didn't work, did it? Thanks a lot, Lord. I stepped out for you, and look what happened." And as clear as anything, I just felt him saying, "Not everyone has to be a story, Christine. Not everyone has to be a story." And that's so good for us to hear, isn't it? We do it because we know it's right. We do it because in obedience. And we keep doing it, whatever the response. It's simply an act of obedience. God calls servants, not heroes. And as one commentator said, obedience is essential, heroism optional. We're called to obedience and dependence. That's the message from Gideon. Gideon was a nobody who was made into a somebody simply because he learnt to recognise God's voice and to follow his call. And his confidence grows, his faith rises to a new level as he steps out in obedience. "Watch me, follow my lead," Gideon says, verse 17. I mean, what a difference from the previous chapter when he bleats, you know, how can I save Israel? I'm the weakest of the weak. And just look where he takes them. Verse 19. It's a crazy plan. In the dead of night, you know, smashing jugs, brandishing torches, blowing ram's horns and bellowing a war cry, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. It's absolutely mad. And do you see the irony in that call? The Israelites didn't lift a single sword in the battle. As far as I can see, they didn't even have any hands free to lift a sword. You know, even if they wanted to, they were already juggling, you know, they needed a lesson probably, pots and horns and torches. The Israelites didn't brandish a single sword. The victory was the Lord's. Each man, we're told, simply held his position round the camp, while verse 22 describes the mayhem in the Midianite camp below. When the 300 trumpets sound, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. It's all the Lord's doing. What a victory. And it's all because Gideon had been courageous enough to obey against the odds. And his courage to take those risks came from learning to trust God in a way he'd never done before. Trusting God in a way he'd never done before. Courage to face his fears first and foremost, even deep-seated ones from the past. Courage to go that little bit further than he'd been before. Courage to take God at his word, to learn to trust him. Courage to be obedient even though he didn't always understand what it was all about. We're called to obedience and dependence. That's the message from Gideon. Let's stand, shall we? Let's stand and let's again just take a moment. Because this call to obedience is one for each one of us. None of us are exempt from this call. None of us have made it. We all know, are probably all too aware of our weaknesses, of our excuses, of the distractions, of the reasons why not, rather than the reasons why we will. And there's always this call, Lord, we recognize this call to further obedience. And we want to be people of yours who respond to that call, who are ready to hear your voice, just as that young boy Samuel did, said, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. And we want to be men and women who say, speak, Lord, for your servant is willing and ready to hear. And I wonder in what ways God is prompting each one of us to go that little bit further than we've been before in trusting him, in obedience to him, stepping out in obedience. What might that look like in our lives? What might that look like for each one of us? Because it's going to be different for each one of us. Is it stepping out in witness, in saying, yes, I will stand for you, Lord. I will show myself as one of yours. Is it simply that? Is it stepping out in not just witness, in not just standing for him, but in sharing him, in evangelism? Have we lost that vision, that obedience towards sharing him, sharing his gospel, sharing his truth, sharing himself? For some of us, it may be stepping into a new area of ministry or work or influence. Again, we know that call, we've heard it. And with some reason, we've held back. For some of us, it's that simple thing of acting on his promptings. Again, we know that we've heard him. We've heard his promptings. And we've been too anxious, too aware of ourselves, too fearful to follow those promptings. But you know, when we obey, we set in motion a whole chain of God events. And I think he wants us to just see it like that, as a chain. We're part of the chain. And if we break the chain, then a whole motion of God events in other people's lives are curtailed. We are given the privilege of being part of God's purposes, part of God's plans, not just for our own life, not just for those close around us, but for an extraordinary number of people who we come into contact with. Will we be part of that chain of obedience? Because if we don't obey, what blessing might we have prevent another person receiving? What blessing might we prevent another person from receiving? Stepping out in obedience may simply be putting aside our excuses and saying, I will, Lord, for you, I'll do this for you. Stepping out in obedience may mean something in our personal life, maybe something in our hidden life. It may mean addressing a habit, something that we know we're not comfortable with. We haven't been maybe for a long time, and we know God is putting the finger on it, and we know it's got to be an act of obedience to stop it and turn and do things differently. Maybe it'll be addressing an area of our thought life. Maybe it's envy, maybe it's dissatisfaction, maybe it's pride, something that's going wrong in our thought life. And again, we know this will need an act of obedience in just turning and saying no more, no longer. Maybe it's an attitude towards others, an attitude towards our money, our possessions, our time. It's an act of obedience. And I don't know what God is laying on your mind, your heart right now. But I know that speaking these things out often disempowers the enemy. It's a powerful thing when we speak these things out. So what I want you to do is to, I want men to speak to men, a man to speak to man, and a woman to speak to a woman. And I want you just to turn to one other person and maybe just say, whatever level you feel you can share, just one thing, one way in which you can respond to this call to obedience, and then to pray for each other, to pray it in. Will you do that? Because I think there is something very powerful when we share, when we speak out loud, when we admit, and when we confirm what God is saying and doing in each other's lives. And I know this may be something that's a little unnerving for some of you. So do it at whatever level you feel you can share, whatever level you feel you can do this on. But let's go for it, because this call to obedience is too important. Okay, let's just move, and you may like to just find woman to woman, man to man. If you have to go in a three, do, but a two is better. And share for a little while, and then I'm going to call you to pray, because the combination of sharing and praying is really important. Everyone find someone. If you have to go in a three, that's fine.